Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the January 14th, 2021 meeting of the Education Finance Committee. For members and members of the public, remote hearings are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents of their virtual packets available to them, and for the public, these meeting materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they are attached in the calendar event you have that Ms. Burt sent out today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. If a member is on their phone and doesn't have access to the raise your hand feature, please email Ms. Burt and she will put your question in the queue. This is the digital equivalent of getting the attention of the chair or the committee administrator. An email from your House account with the subject line, please recognize, is all that is required if you're on your phone. Ms. Sunderland, would you please call the roll?
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sandsted. Vice Chair Representative Sandsted. Representative Kreisha is excused. Representative Bennett is also excused. Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damath.
Present.
Sorry. I knew it was coming up.
Not a problem. Representative Drazkowski. Representative Drazkowski. Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Marquardt is excused. Representative Mueller. Present. Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Thompson is also excused. Representative Wolgamott.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
And one last backtrack. Representative Sandsted, I see you on the call here. Are you able to unmute? We're going to mark her here. We'll touch base with her. And I do see that
Sandsted is present.
Perfect. There it is. And I also do see that at this point, Representative Drazkowski has joined us.
Drazkowski's present.
Wonderful. And that is the roll.
And we have a quorum then. Thank you, Ms. Sunderland. Representative Erickson, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes from yesterday's meeting?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes from January 13th's meeting.
Thank you very much. Are there any objections? Hearing none, if members want to unmute, all those in favor of approving the minutes from Wednesday, January 13th, please say aye.
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 Any opposed, nay? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Members, today we'll finish our overview from House Research, and we'll also be hearing from Minnesota Management and Budget and the Minnesota Department of Education about the forecasting process. These are technical issues, but important for our deliberations and development of budget for the 2021 session in the 22-23 biennium. So please feel free to ask any and all questions as we move through these materials. It's helpful for us and the public to hear your queries and the answers from House Research and MMB. MMB has a remarkable ability to both understand and explain these issues. We have three presenters with us today from MMB. Lorena Schlotick-Ratcliffe, who's the Executive Budget Officer. Marina Baleria, who's also an Executive Budget Officer with MMB. And then joining us from MDE, the Department of Education, Terry Yetter, who's their school finance director. Who is up first? I'll let you all arm wrestle.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lorena Shattuck-Ratcliffe, Executive Budget Officer at MMB, and I can begin the presentation.
Thank you. Please do.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am joined by my colleagues today, Marina Bellaria, an Executive Budget Officer at MMB, and Terry Yatter, the School Finance Director at MDE. Today we will be sharing a brief presentation with you all covering a high-level overview of the November forecast, focusing on the portions of the forecast relating to E12 education. We can go to the next slide. This first slide highlights the key takeaways from the November forecast. The November forecast is on a comparison basis from October end of session, but the forecasted programs are based off of the May budget projection, which was unique due to COVID-19. In the November forecast, the state's finances were significantly improved. However, COVID-19 impacts still remain. In the current year, the projected deficit was eliminated. We now have a $641 million surplus in FY21. This forecast added back about half of the current year, the current biennium's revenue taken out in the May projection. This improved budget outlook continues into the next biennium, FY22-23, but a $1.3 billion shortfall still remains for FY22-23. The pandemic economic downturn has affected all Minnesotans, but unemployment has disproportionately impacted lower wage workers. And one point of note too, there was a December special session, and in the December special session, general fund expenditures increased by $242.3 million in 2021 and $5.2 million in 2022-23. So some of that $641 million surplus is less now. We can move to the next slide. So this table shows the impact in the current biennium, so FY20-21. And at the end of the October special session, the budgetary balance was negative $2.314 billion. In comparison, the November forecast changed that outlook to a surplus of $641 million. And so as you can see, the revenue outlook increased by $1.912 billion and spending decreased by $1.058 billion. And that was largely driven in the health and human services area and in education. Next slide. So this table shows the upcoming biennium, which is 22-23, and the long-term budget outlook. And so you can see that there, the structural balance, the bottom line there, is still projecting a deficit in the upcoming biennium and then in the planning years, 24 and 25. And if you look on the right-hand side, though, we're still seeing biennial growth in our forecast. So year over year, expenditures are increasing as well as forecasted revenues. And I will turn it over to Terry Yetter, who can talk about some of the education-related forecast changes.
Ms. Yetter, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I apologize. It looks like I was still on mute. So I will start again. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Terry Yetter. I'm the School Finance Director with the Department of Education. And I will walk through the remaining slides that are the specific education portions of the forecast. If you go to the next slide. This table is the change in education expenditures from end of session. Or as Lorena pointed out, The data that we were using was based on our February forecast from last year. The E-12 education represents about 42% of the total state's general fund spending, so it's a large share of the forecasted expenditures. Overall spending on E-12 education is projected to be down about $18 million, or about 0.6% in the 2021 biennium, and then down another $154 million or 0.7% for the 2023 biennium compared to our end of session estimates. The biggest item that accounts for the change is the general education aid program. This accounts for most of the change, and it's a decline of $84 million in the 2021 biennium and then $83 million in the 22-23 biennium. General education represents 74% of total education spending, so it's by far and away the largest portion of education spending. This is the primary source. The education general education program is the primary source of basic operating funds for schools, and is largely determined by the number of pupils served. A forecast decline in pupils, public school pupils, is the primary driver of the change that we're seeing in general education. Most of general education revenue is in the basic formula, which is a uniform allowance per pupil. But the changes in pupils also affect other components of general education revenue, such as local optional revenue, equity revenue, and operating capital revenue. Then another large component at about 6% of gen ed revenue is compensatory revenue. And there is some additional drivers of the change in the forecast for this portion of general education. Compensatory revenue is based on the number and concentration of students eligible for free and reduced price meals. The underreporting in this area that we are experiencing this year also contributes to the overall decrease in general education spending. And as you recall, during the December special session, there was the bill that was passed and enacted, which allowed the department to continue collecting the eligibility forms from families and school districts for an additional couple of weeks in December and into early January. The next item is special education. And in the 22-23 biennium, special education is declining by about $47 million. That's about 1.2%. And that's primarily due to lower projected expenditures in the prior year, which would be FY21 and 22. Which is attributable to lower projected pupil counts. Expenditure per pupil growth is also slightly lower than in the previous forecast. So even though special education spending or state aid is largely based on expenditures, we do rely heavily on the pupil forecast to help us to do projections of those expenditures.
Ms. Yetter? Yeah. Zitter, can I just ask that you speak up just a little bit? I think just a little bit more for me, please.
Sure. Let me also turn up my my audio just a tad as well.
The technology comes to the rescue.
Yes. Thank you for mentioning that. I will try to also speak a little bit louder as well here. The next category is nutrition programs, which are also down. This is due to the pandemic and changing learning models, as many schools have been utilizing federal programs to provide meals to students, resulting in underspending on the state side. Then for debt service equalization, that's down due to fewer than expected new bond referendums from this fall. And inter-district desegregation transportation is also down due to depressed growth in transportation expenditures for these programs and the residual pupil loss attributable to COVID. Then on the next slide, this next slide shows the biennial growth change in general fund education expenditures. Overall education expenditures or education spending is expected to increase by 3.6% in the first biennium and then another 3.7% in the second biennium. General education is expected to increase by only 1.5% in the first biennium, while overall categorical education programs are expected to grow by almost 12% over this same period. The largest growth rate is in special education, which accounts for 17% of the total general education spending. Then the next slide, the last slide in our presentation, we talk more in detail about the pupil projection, since that is the key driver to the change in the forecast this year. This is the area that we focus our most attention on in our forecast methodology. So this last slide shows us the changes in pupil projections that we used in our forecast. The numbers that you see here are actual through FY19, and then we also were using our preliminary actual, early look at actual data for FY20. This is a continuing from there. So what you see on the top line, the gray line, is going to be the actuals through FY19, and then the remaining years show the projection that we had in place for end of session. Then continuing from there, the dashed line that's in the middle shows our modeling prior to making adjustments for COVID. Our traditional modeling process looks at near-term enrollment trends by grade level and projects based on the ratio of students moving from one grade level to the next. And so what we did for the projection this year was we're now taking into consideration our preliminary actual FY20 data. So we have one additional year data point for the projection model. So what we see is with our preliminary actual 20 data is that there's a continuation of the downward trend in growth rates since FY18. And so this brings the November projections down from what we had been using for end of session. And for FY21, the November projections are now showing about a 4,300 drop in students than what we had from the previous forecast. Because our normal process for projections is largely based on the near-term trend data, we had to do kind of an overlay to our normal process to take into consideration the impacts of the COVID pandemic. So the bottom blue line represents the impact of the COVID pandemic and implementation of distance learning that was in response to the pandemic. Because these changes are more recent than what can be captured in our normal modeling, we did an analysis of this overlay to our normal process. So in response to the COVID-19 pandemic and implementation of distance learning, some families were seeing, as you have also heard, we're seeing some families have chosen to delay kindergarten enrollment for a year or pursue other non-public and homeschool options. And this has had a significant impact decreasing public school enrollments. What you see here from the drop in 21 is it's primarily impacting the FY21 school year. And so we're expecting an additional 8,300 fewer public school pupils this year as a result of the response that families are making to the pandemic. The November forecast assumes a COVID vaccine would become available about mid-calendar year 2021. So that's the assumptions we had at the time that we were doing the November forecast were probably a little bit more conservative than I think what we're seeing currently from the progress that's been made with the vaccine rollout. So with the assumptions that we had in place for our November forecast, we are expecting with the vaccine to become available more like mid-year this year, we would be expecting many families to start returning to public schools beginning next school year. And so with these assumptions, we're still expecting some COVID impact on public school enrollments to continue in through FY 22 and 23, but that we would be, by the time we get to our out years in our forecast, we would see much of the impact on public school enrollments to be more or less over by the time we get to out to FY 25. That concludes the information that we have to present, and we would be happy to take any questions that the members might have. Thank you.
Rep. Devney, you're muted.
Thank you, Ms. Yetter. We do have at least one member with a question. Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Ms. Yetter, for such a concise overview. Finally getting my head wrapped around it this morning. I know that COVID has really made that ADM number, since it's such a big part of our formula, kind of bounce around a lot. And hopefully once fall hits, it'll stabilize out. But I'm wondering, remind me again, have we had inflation in the formula before? I can't quite remember.
Ms. Yetter?
Thank you, Representative. We don't have, when we look at our forecasted programs, we do have inflation that is based on what is already in the statutory formulas. So we would be doing our projections based on the increase in number of pupils. We would apply some assumptions to increases, inflationary increases in the cost of expenditures. So that would go into our forecast methodology as well. For like operating referendums, we actually have a component directly tied to inflation with the consumer price index. So all of that gets built in. What we don't do with inflation is we don't assume any increase in allowances or anything that's outside of the current statutory authority. So data gets inflated, but the formulas themselves do not.
So we don't have, thank you, Chair Dabney, I have to get used to this again. So we don't have inflation tied to the expenditures, we just have it in the forecast model. Have we ever had inflation tied into the general ed formula before as an expenditure?
Ms. Yetter?
Yes, Representative. The formula allowance increase that we do see fairly regularly introduced as changes in legislation, those are amounts that are set in the statute. And so we do, when we do our projections of education expenditures, we are looking strictly just at the allowances that are in place with the statute. So basically, our forecast for this year, we would be looking at the formula allowance through FY21, and then we use that same formula allowance for each year in the out years of the forecast.
Thank you, Ms. Yetter. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. I'm still a little bit confused. I'm just trying to see. Our education formula is not tied to inflation. I know the forecast is, but the formula itself does not automatically go up. Is that accurate?
Ms. Yetter?
Yes, Representative, that is accurate.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question, if you...
Certainly.
Thank you. So I'm just wondering, since we already have some instability in our formula because our ADM can change, would adding an inflationary increase in the formula help smooth out that instability so districts could plan further out?
And is that for Ms. Yetter?
Ms. Yetter or MMB or whoever would like to answer.
Who's got that one?
I will go ahead and that. When you look at the basic formula, it'll be a combination of the formula allowance times the number of pupils. So it's a pretty straightforward formula. It does provide such a large portion of the operating revenues for school districts that there is a direct impact of reducing the public school enrollments on the amount of money that the districts have available for budgeting. Now, there is a declining enrollment provision or category within general education revenue, which helps to soften that impact. Generally speaking, if districts have fewer pupils coming in, they aren't necessarily able to reduce their budgets for their operating programs at the same rate that they're seeing the reduction in revenues. And so an increase in formula allowance, would certainly, when you look at the impact on the revenues, would help to offset the declining in enrollments. Because each of those factors, each of those two sides of the formula, an increase in one or the other, would have an impact on the overall revenue.
Representative Youakim?
No, thank you very much.
All right. I wonder, Representative Youakim, if the issue is also about planning and stability of finances to enhance planning in school districts. The variability in funding just simply makes that more difficult. Other members with questions? Ms. Valeria, we have not heard from you. Do you have additional information to share, or did you push these folks out in front and let them testify today?
Exactly. Thank you, Chair. I don't have any further comments.
Well done. All right. Then thank you both for joining us today, Ms. Schladek-Ratcliffe and Ms. Yetter, for coming in and sharing with us. Much appreciated. At this point, we'll transition, I think, back to some of the presentation that was started yesterday by our own nonpartisan staff. And as I recall, Ms. Adrians, you were presenting as we adjourned yesterday. Is that where we pick up, or what is your preference?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if you all can stand to listen to us talk for a little bit longer, we have a few more pages in the presentation.
Very good.
Thank you, Ms. Burt. Mr. Chair and members, so some of these items will be reiterations of things that we heard this morning from the agencies and also some items that we talked about yesterday. So we left off talking about the general education revenue area of the budget. And so once again, this chart shows some of the different revenue categories that fall underneath that general education revenue piece. This shows the total in aid and levy amount that the school districts receive. And by looking at that big chunk of the pie, that basic formula aid that, like we said, that comprises about 71% of the revenue that the districts receive. So if we go to the next page, these are just a couple of points that we wanted to make about the basic formula allowance. As I said, it is the biggest chunk of the general education revenue piece. The amount for fiscal year 21 and going forward at this point that is set in law is that $6,567 per pupil unit. As Ms. Yetter was saying, this is the formula. It's just taking that amount and multiplying it by the number of pupil units that each school district has. So it's a pretty straightforward formula compared to some of the other formulas that we have. And it's used for the, as we kind of covered yesterday, that ADM, the average daily membership, that's the pupil unit calculation that we use for that formula. This formula allowance, it's the same for every school district and charter school in the state, so there are no variations for the basic formula across school districts. As Representative Joachim was asking, we don't link this formula to inflation. So there's no automatic increase for the basic formula allowance. Currently, the only way that it increases is if there is a change in the legislation. And then we have, because the number of pupil units, it's close to that 1 million mark, we have kind of a nice rule of thumb if you wanted to do sort of a quick calculation to how much an increase in the basic formula allowance would cost. So for each dollar that we increase the formula unit, so that $6,500 number, for each dollar that we increase it by, the cost is about $1 million. So if that dollar amount were increased by 1%, that's about a $66 change in that formula allowance. And so the cost would be close to $66 million per year. I hope that makes sense, and we're happy to talk more about that in the future. And now I think I will turn it over to Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, the next slide in front of you shows the general education basic formula allowance over time. You've seen a variety of graphs on school revenue, and I think it's helpful to recognize a few things that are going on with school district revenue. As Ms. Yetter's information showed, some parts of school funding are increasing at rates well above inflation, things like special education and certain other categorical aids. And other things are increasing at about the rate of inflation, and some others are below that. This chart, because as Ms. Adrian said, the basic formula allowance is such a major part of the funding system, this chart just looks at the basic formula allowance over time. There's three lines on the chart. The blue line at the bottom shows the actual statutory formula allowances over time from 2003 forward to 2021. So over that 20-year period, you can see the formula allowance went from $4,601 per pupil unit to $6,567 per pupil unit. The green line recognizes that the weighting, and we talked about this earlier when we talked about counting students, that the weighting has changed for various pupil levels. Primarily, the secondary weighting has gone down over time. And so when you take out the adjustment for pupil weighting, because obviously if you weighted the pupils at twice as much as they currently are, you'd need half the formula allowance, and vice versa. If you cut the weighting in half, you'd need twice the formula allowance to generate the same amount of money. If you take out the weighting changes, then you can see the reality essentially is that the basic formula allowance alone grew from $4,966 to the same $6,567. And then the top line, the red line, says, well, what if we adjusted that for inflation? Where would we be if there was an inflation adjustment to that? And using the CPI as the measure of inflation, the same formula allowance over time, you can see that would have gone down essentially since 2003 from $7,149 of inflation adjusted amount to its current amount of $6,567. So again, this is just the basic formula allowance. There's lots of reasons to look at other statistics as well, including overall general ed revenue and overall school district revenue. But this chart is designed to give you some context for the discussion about the basic formula allowance. Next slide. And now we're going to go to a printout, a general education revenue printout. This is the second of the series of printouts you'll see. And as we discussed before, for purposes of displaying these and when we pass them out at committee hearings, we turn them into PDFs for you. Makes them accessible, it makes them easier to read, but we have all this information in spreadsheet formulas, and we can sort them, we can compare, we can do a lot of tasks with these, but this is sort of the standard way that a PIP printout will look. We'll generally try to give you a little bit of context at the top of the printout, usually by using a strata of school districts that gives some groupings so that you can look at more than just an individual district list. And then we'll list the school district and charter school name and numbers as we go down the page. A couple of interesting rules of thumb. Minnesota's school district numbers were assigned based on the county number. So generally speaking, if you're in County 62, which is Ramsey County, the three-digit school district number, the first two of those three districts will be, our numbers will be in the 620s. So Ramsey County's districts are 621, for Moundsview through 625. And Hennepin County is 27, so most of Hennepin County district is in the 270s. So when we use school district number order as opposed to alphabetical order, one of the benefits of that is it puts districts that are geographically within the same county right next to each other. But again, we can sort these lists alphabetically or in other ways if that's more helpful to members. As we move across the printout, and a quick word about the data, the wonderful professional staff at MDE and MMB help us with our data needs. And until the February forecast comes out, we'll be using the November forecast of pupil counts and pupil data in all of our printouts. MDE may well have a better idea now of where pupil counts are compared to the data that went into the November forecast, but we'll make the change all at once at the same time as the Senate and the executive branch in early March when the February forecast is released. And the reason for that is we don't wanna have arguments with each other about what the proper pupil count should be. We want that to be agreed to so that the House and Senate can think about differences in policy and what the difference numbers mean. That first column then of data is the adjusted pupil units. Districts report to the department how many students they have by grade level. And then how many they're serving, the resident served is factored into that. And you can see there just slightly less than that $1 million or 1 million count that we use as our rule of thumb, about 946,158 pupil units are expected in the public school system in the 2021 school year. And you can see up and down the list how those amounts vary by district, and you can see them in those seven strata. How many are in the suburban, inner ring suburbs, outer ring, greater Minnesota districts under 1,000 students, et cetera. And then as you go down the list, you'll see the pupil count for each district. As we go over then, across the top of the printout, each of these categories, which we refer to as components of general education revenue, depend on a statutory amount. The first of those that Ms. Adrian's just mentioned was the basic formula allowance, and that's set in law. That doesn't have an increase built into it unless the legislature changes it. That's set at $6,567 for the current year and for each future year. And you can see that that's the one part of general education revenue that's the same for every school district in the state. So all the way up and down the list, everybody there is going to be at $6,567 per pupil unit. And as the pie chart showed, that's 71% of total general education revenue. As you go across the printout, you'll see all of the other components of general education, and we'll talk about a few of these separately. But these are all statutorily determined, and they're all variable depending on the conditions that the statute has assigned to them. For example, the third column in compensatory revenue is based on free and reduced lunch counts in each district. It's a concentration formula, and you can see some substantial variation in the amount among the strata of districts for compensatory revenue and amongst the individual districts. Other elements of the formula that show wide variation. If you we'll look at operating and transportation sparsity revenue, And you can see these are relative, the amount per pupil shown on that top row there. But you can see that the variation is wildly different amongst different districts, but intentionally so. Those are the results of formulas that the legislature has enacted to fund schools. A point worth making that a small change in operating sparsity revenue doesn't have a big increase, or a big change rather, doesn't have a big increase on the overall state budget because the number of pupils affected by that are quite small. But you can see the variation among the strata there is significant. And so there are purposes behind these various formulas that the legislature has determined as a reason why there should be a variation in school funding amongst districts. We'll spend a lot more time on each of these categories as we hear bills this session. But a few takeaways before we go to the specific printouts for you. Usually at the very right, there'll be a total. We're always happy to show total revenue as well as total per pupil, but because of column limitations, both for ease of readability and printing on single pages, we tend to just show per pupil amounts. You can see that the total general education revenue per school district is $9,307 per pupil unit. And you can see the variation amongst districts in the columns as you go up and down the list. And one last word before we leave the general education program, the operating referendum that the voters in your districts approve or disapprove are the third to last column. And that's by statutory definition part of general education revenue. But that amount is entirely dependent on the amounts that the voters in each district have approved as additional school funding. And those referendum can last for up to 10 years. They're primarily levy, and we'll talk a little more about the mix of aid and levy. But as you look across the printout here, what you see are all the categories of general education revenue. Next slide, please. We talked briefly about compensatory revenue, and you've all got that printout to refer back to. School districts and charter schools qualify for compensatory revenue based on each school's percentage of students who are eligible. When the free and reduced price meal count is the count that's used to determine that. That's what we refer to as a proxy variable. It's not the eligibility or the qualifying for free and reduced lunch that is important, but it serves as the proxy for those schools that may need additional funding. Free and reduced lunch counts are determined through a direct match using other data that the Department of Human Services collects that's reported to districts. And it's also collected through the submission of paper eligibility forms submitted by each student's family. As was briefly mentioned by MMB and MDE this morning, as the in the last year or two, there's been a decline in the amount of forms that have been turned in. This false count is expected to be depressed fairly substantially from where it would otherwise be, in part because of the lack of in-person attendance by a number of students. That count is lagged by a year, essentially. So the fall of 20 count for compensatory revenue actually won't come into play in the compensatory revenue formula until fiscal year 22. Finally, the compensatory revenue is one of the largest, as the pie chart showed a few pages back, it's one of the largest components of general education. It's also the one where there tends to be the most controversy, and in part that's because it is a concentration formula where the amount changes not just for the amount of students who are eligible, but rather by the percentage and amount. So the more concentration a district has at a particular site, the higher per free and reduced lunch student the compensatory revenue is. Next slide, please. Another component of general education revenue is the English learner revenue. This is not only about an eighth as large as compensatory revenue in total revenue, but it's an important part of the formula, and it compensates school districts for a portion of their costs of providing additional services to students who are English language learners. It's a two-part formula. It has a basic formula of $704 per English learner student, and there's also a concentration element that can bring a district up to another $250 per English learner pupil. Eligibility for English learner funding in Minnesota is for up to 7 years. Districts may serve a child longer than that time period, but for funding purposes, 7 years is the maximum that a district can claim reimbursement. There's also a significant gap in English learner aid between the amount that goes to districts as revenue and the amount that districts spend on English learner services. We've got a printout for you that shows English learner revenue. And this is oriented the same way. Again, we could sort this printout in any number of ways that's helpful to you. We're using a different pupil count here in the first column. We're using pupils served. Adjusted average daily membership is what AADM stands for. That's an unweighted count of pupils, and you can see that's less than the 946,000 that showed up on the previous printout because that was a weighted count of pupils. As we move across the printout, you can see that there are 63,515 English language learner students eligible for funding in Minnesota, and that it's about 7.2% of the overall enrollment in Minnesota schools. You can see this amount varies dramatically by district. We talked briefly about this yesterday. At the strata, you can see the variation in the percentage of English learners served by each district. And as you look down the list, both in Greater Minnesota and in the metro area, you'll see that districts that can be right next to each other, for example, Centennial District 12 has 2% of its students who are English learners, and District 13, Columbia Heights, has 25% of its students who are eligible for English learner funding. The funding formula actually has a minimum in it. We don't need to go into detail too much about the formula, but if a district has at least one English learner student, the district is assumed to have 20 for purposes of providing a minimum level of funding. That's a not uncommon manner of school funding formulas to have a minimum. The community ed formulas have a minimum sort of similar to that to provide that there's, if there's some service being provided, that there's a minimum level of funding for that service. The two parts of the formula we talked about, the basic revenue is $46 million. The concentration revenue is just under $13 million for a total of $59 million of English learner revenue for fiscal year 21, or $67 per average daily membership. That's a helpful number to put it in context to the amount that we spend on the basic formula allowance. And then finally, the last three columns on this printout show the difference between the expenditures on the most recent year available to us when we put this printout together was fiscal year 19. You can see school districts coded and spent about $166 million on English learner services for fiscal year 19. The revenue at that time was a little less than showing for 21. That revenue was $58.9 million. And this concept that is referred to in English learner and special ed formulas of the cross subsidy shows the amount of the difference between the expenditures and the revenue that comes out of other parts of the school district's budget. And for fiscal year 19, that was $107 million cross subsidy. So, Mr. Chair, members, that's a brief explanation of the English Learner Revenue Program. There's certainly more detail on all of these programs in the School Finance Guidebook if members are interested in the specific calculations or the history of the program.
Mr. Strom, thank you for that. Those are complicated spreadsheets, and you always do such an excellent job of walking us through the different components. I appreciate the cross-subsidy being included on the EL formula because I think it's important for committee members to understand not only what we fund, but also what school districts spend and where there may be gaps. So I think that was very helpful. Thank you for that. Questions from members? Mr. Strom, it looks like you did it again.
Mr. Chair, I see that Feist has a question.
My apologies. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, this may not be possible, but I would be so curious
if you could provide a concrete comparison between how the cross-subsidy situation plays out in disparate school districts. So in a school district with a lot of property taxes and community donations to the public schools, like I would love to know how it plays out in that scenario. And then in another school where they, you know, where they have less resources, you know, I understand like just the math that they take money out of the general fund to meet those obligations. But I'm just curious, do you have any kind of, can you walk us through like a practical comparison and how it plays out in like two different specific school districts?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Strong.
There are a couple of ways that one could compare. If you go, and we don't need to pull this up on the screen at the time, but if you pull back up from yesterday, the file that shows total revenue by district, you'll see that a lot of school districts that are toward the top of the list have large amounts of funding in things like compensatory revenue and English learner revenue. So I think you'll find as you look through data that some school districts are experiencing bigger cross subsidies in some areas than others. It's hard to know exactly what an even comparison is. Certainly one thing that comes into play is that the dollars that are voter approved for the operating referendum, as you mentioned, those depend in part on the willingness of a community to tax itself, which depends on tax base in that community. And we could certainly, if Ms. Burt wouldn't mind putting the general education printout back on the screen, you could see that there's a substantial variation in that third to last column, in that operating referendum per pupil column. You can see a very substantial variation across districts. And for example, if you were to look at the Minneapolis School District, District 1.3 on this printout, the district has a large amount of English learner revenue in $125 per pupil in that category, but they also have a very large operating referendum of $1,779 per pupil. A district like Columbia Heights that showed up on the English learning printout has $229 of English learning, English learner revenue per pupil unit, but only $309 of voter approved operating referendum. So as an example of how those districts may be, and I'm not picking on either of these districts, but they just make a nice comparison, one could imagine that there's a greater ability to cross-subsidize in some districts than in others, depending on whether the voters are willing to approve a referendum and how large that referendum is. But if you go back and look at that overall total revenue printout, you may be surprised to see that some of the largest tax-based districts in the state, those with the largest property tax bases, are toward the bottom of that list, and that's because most of these factors, most of these components of general education are relatively low for them. We can pull this data together in any number of different ways, but it's often very, very difficult for us to identify a particular reason why one district's financial situation may be worse than another. For example, what we're going to get to special education in a moment, and districts may have very different levels of special education cross-subsidy as well as EL cross-subsidy. So it's hard to say much definitively with just one or two elements of school funding, but certainly these are all issues that you as policymakers need to consider, which are the ability to access levy, whether that's through tax base or community views, the other formulas that exist, and the needs in the community that exist.
Representative Feist, any follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question and one request regarding the data you just discussed. For Columbia Heights, does that incorporate the recent levy that they passed to support the schools?
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Feist, the levy, if the levy was passed this fall, it would not be in there yet because that's first effective for taxes payable 21, which is fiscal year 22. So if there was a referendum this fall in Columbia Heights, that would not yet be in the data.
Thank you.
Representative Feist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's good to know. And then the request I have is, I understand in a really macro level this cross-subsidy issue, but I would be so interested to see like the actual budget for two different school districts and how it impacts those school districts differently, just so we can see like where the money is coming out of the general fund and what that means in terms of cuts to programming. So if that's something that your office could prepare, I would love to see just like a side-by-side breakdown of how that cross-subsidy issue plays out in two different communities. So thank you so much.
Mr. Straub, is that something that you can help with, or are there others that might step in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Feitz, that's a really good question. I need to think a bit about how best to do that. Each school district's budget is constructed somewhat differently. There's a wonderful tool on the Department of Education's website that's called the Consolidated Funds Statement. And that tries to make a two-page summary of how each district's spending works according to categories, percent on salaries, those kinds of things. So that could be helpful in some ways, but it's very hard to know exactly how a cross-subsidy in one area might be identified for its impact on the whole budget. Let me think about this a bit, a very interesting question. Let me think about what data we might be able to assemble on that, but I'm reluctant to overpromise here because there's just so many factors in terms of a district's budget and how the district's planning. And one thing that's important to remember for school district budgeting is the majority of the cost in each school district's budget is its employee costs, and those are driven both by the number of employees and the maturity essentially of the teaching staff. So districts can be at very different cycles on that maturity level. A district with all of its teachers, you know, averaging 30 years of experience is going to have a higher payroll than a similarly situated district that has an average of 10 years. And often on these financial comparisons, years of experience and age, training level of the teachers, it comes into play in terms of where the district's at. But let me think, and I'll put some information together on this for Representative Feist and the committee, and it may not get to the answer we're looking for, but it can be a starting place.
Thank you, Mr. Straub. And members, Representative Feist, and Mr. Straub just illustrated very well the willingness of our nonpartisan staff to provide us with answers to our questions, to do deep dives on the mountain of data, I think, that they have sitting in their computers. And I would urge members, either through the committee process or offline, to certainly ask the questions you have of staff in order to explore the questions that you have on the funding formula and any number of issues. I can also assure Representative Feist that the way the legislature often works is there's somebody watching who very much wants to get you the answer to your question and will be following up with you. I don't know who and I don't know when, but I wouldn't be surprised. Lots of help, people willing to help around here. Any other questions from members before we move on? Seeing none then, Mr. Strom, Ms. Adrians, Ms. Pera, who's up next?
Mr. Chair, I think next we're going to be moving to page 35, and this is a brief description of special education revenue. We'll have much more discussion about special education revenue as session wears on. As was pointed out with the earlier pie charts, the second biggest share and the fastest growing share of revenue in the K-12 budget is special education revenue. Special education revenue is primarily funded through state aid. There's some federal funds, but those have declined as a percentage of the total over time. Our formula for special education revenue in Minnesota is primarily a cost reimbursement formula. So generally speaking, the expenditures in the previous year are those that are driving the input variables to the special education formula. There's a large gap in Minnesota between special education revenue and the expenditures that districts make. We refer to this as the cross-subsidy, and just as with English learning revenue, this cross-subsidy varies dramatically amongst districts. And lastly, an issue that's increased in importance over the last several years regarding special education is, as we mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, most funding formulas are based on pupils served, and the funding generally goes to the serving district. But for special education, there's one more step in the process, and that is if there are unreimbursed costs remaining for students who open enroll or attend charter schools, the charter school or open and enrolling school district, the serving school district, may bill those costs back to the resident district. And under current law for fiscal year 21 and later, 80% of the unreimbursed costs are billed back to the state. And for charter schools, another 10% of the points of those costs are billed back to the resident district. And for charter schools, 10% are billed back to the state into essentially a portion of the funding formula. This issue's received quite a bit more attention in the last few years, and we'll see some of the implications of this when we look at the special education revenue spreadsheet. The first chart here in your packet shows that cross subsidy over time, both adjusted for inflation on the red line and not adjusted for inflation on the blue line. You can see that cross subsidy, these amounts are in millions of dollars, grew substantially through 2007 and fell pretty significantly, then increased pretty sharply after the budget crisis the state experienced in 2010-11, and then has somewhat stabilized since then and has been reduced a bit to about $845 million. In simplest terms, that means once the special ed revenues accounted for districts, another $845 million of general education revenue, essentially from one source or another, needs to be applied to the special education costs that a district faces. Next slide, please. This chart shows special education aid over time, and I think it's important to point out that the legislature has significantly increased the special education aid. The blue line at the bottom is the not inflation adjusted line. The red line at the top is the adjusted for inflation line, and you can see that over the 20-year period on an inflation adjusted basis, the special education aid in millions of dollars has almost doubled. From $1,096 million back in 2003 to $2,030 million in 2021. So the legislature's formulas have allocated substantially more revenue to special education, but at the same time, that cross subsidy remains quite large for most districts. We can look, just as we do with general education components, we can look at special education by school district and by strata. And this printout that's in your packet shows the regular special education aid, the excess cost aid, the cross subsidy reduction aid, and the hold harmless aid, and then looks at the net tuition adjustment. These are the bill backs to the resident districts, and then total makes the charter school adjustment, and then has a total special education aid, and for fiscal 21, about $1.76 billion of state aid is the state aid portion of special education aid, or about $1,857 per pupil unit, not per special ed child, but per total pupil unit. So you can see that these amounts are significant and second only to general education revenue as a part of school district budgets. If we took an example of a district, and we can also show cross subsidies here, this printout didn't have space to show that, as long as we're using Columbia Heights as an example today, and we can sure use a different district as well. You can, as you read across the line for District 13, you can see that the Columbia Heights School District has 3,534 pupil units. The regular special education formulas, which are described in the school finance guide, yield about $6.7 million. The excess aid portion of the formula, about $770,000. The cross subsidy aid, $415,000. And then if you go over to the net tuition column, you can see that the district's special education aid, because a large number of students who are resident to Columbia Heights attend school outside of the resident district, the net tuition billing for that district reduces their aid by about $3.2 million. So almost more than a third, less, slightly less than half of the district's total special education aid that it would otherwise receive is then transferred to other charter schools and school districts through the tuition billing adjustment, so that the net for the school district is $4.697 million of special education revenue. So Representative Feist had asked earlier about how these cross subsidies work and how individual budgets are determined. And you can see here that this is an example of an item that a school district has no control over, that is the number of students who choose to open enroll elsewhere. But because of the bill back to the resident district has a substantial amount of money that's reduced in exchange in payment rather to the other school districts and charter schools that the students from that district attend. You can look up and down the list. You can see some school districts' net tuition adjustment is relatively small. Those districts don't have much bill back. A district like Minneapolis is quite large. On line 1.2 there, you can see about a almost $30 million reduction in the special education aid the district incurs because of the bill backs. Over the last 5 years, the net tuition column, the percent that's billed back for unreimbursed expenses, has become a much more significant part of the debate regarding the school finance system. And you can see in the strata there at the top that these tuition adjustments net to zero, and then you can see where districts are gaining and losing revenue in total under this tuition billback. And the essentially the two groups that are significant winners under that, but don't have other sources of revenue like the referendum, are the charter schools at $83.9 million, and the co-ops, which are primarily in the metropolitan area, the intermediate school districts, of $141 million. So the net tuition pays for special education services for the unreimbursed portion that's not covered by the regular formula. Mr. Chair, members, the last formula we're going to talk about today is the Achievement and Integration Revenue Formula. This is another formula like special education, which we often refer to categorical formulas. Everything outside of general education we refer to as categorical. Out of the 330 school districts in Minnesota, 172 districts qualify for Achievement and Integration Revenue. Those districts all file a plan with the Department of Education, and most of those that do, there are some voluntary plans that are filed, but most of those districts that file a plan are required to do so under Minnesota's integration rule. The Achievement and Integration Revenue is like some other revenues. It's a mix of state aid and local levy. Essentially 70%, it's an unequalized formula, but with an aid and levy component, 70% of the revenue comes from state aid and 30% from the local levy. There's a printout in your packets that shows the Achievement and Integration Revenue for estimated for the 2021 school year. And as you look at this printout, again, the pupils listed here is yet a third pupil count. And in part, that's because this is just a district total number. Charter schools aren't eligible for Achievement and Integration Revenue. So the pupil count that is listed here is only the district total pupil count. And you can see the percent students of color in Minnesota, the Achievement and Integration Revenue is $123 million, of which $86 million is state aid, and $37 million comes from the local property tax. And then you can see for each district, sorted in numeric district order, what their integration revenue looks like. Again, there's a couple of pages in the school finance guide that explain the history of these formulas, as well as how to specifically calculate the formula for each school district.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Dabney, you appear to be muted.
My apologies. I couldn't quite tell who was asking to be recognized.
Christina, hi.
Oh, Ms. Parra, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. And I'm going to just take us the last couple of slides here. We're talking about student movement. As you've heard, our funding system is based on the pupil counts. So that's the number of students that are served by each school district or charter school. Minnesota also allows students to attend school outside of their resident district through open enrollment and also to attend charter schools. And generally the funding will follow the student as you saw through the different spreadsheets Mr. Strom and Ms. Adrians walked you through. Students can also use PSEO, that's the post-secondary enrollment options, to dual enroll in college courses. And students that live on the borders with other states will sometimes enroll in districts in those other states. And we do have some limited reciprocity agreements to account for that funding. And next slide, please. Now you'll see there the link for our website, the House Research website, and there's a kind of a fun lookup tool for members of the public to play around with. And if you click on that link, what that takes you to is our website, and there's a list of spreadsheets there. There you go. And you could select any one of those. I think we're going to look at the 2018 one. And has a series of tabs, and actually I think it's useful to start with the very last one, the furthest one to the right, that says district name and number. That has there, you can see what district you're looking for. It has them listed both by name and number on the left and then alphabetically on the right. And so once you figure out what district you want to look at, and I'll just try to remember number 11 for Anoka Hennepin. You can go to any of the other ones, and we can start with the students entering district tab. That's the second to the left there. And so you can, all the way on the, that's right, on the top where that blue is, if you entered the district number, and let's say you want to look up, right now it's Minnetonka, but let's enter the district number 11. There you go. And so now that populates for Anoka Hennepin. You can see the students that are coming into Anoka Hennepin from other districts. So for example, you can see that from Osseo, there are 981 students coming in. And that goes down the list. You can see there by number and by percentage. You can also see at the top kind of a little summary of number of students that leave the district versus enter, and then kind of a net change in enrollment there. Then if we go to the next tab, please. Students leaving the district, then if we can enter 11 in that top cell there, please. Thank you. That shows you then the number, the students that leave the district. So from Anoka Hennepin, you can see that the largest percentage of students that leave in Anoka Hennepin go to Spring Lake. And there you see that whole list. You can see again at the top the net change in student enrollment. Now these last two tabs that we walked through are just school districts, but in this chat tab you can see the number of students that leave the district to enroll in charter schools. And again, there you go. If you want to look at Anoka Hennepin, you can see that the largest number of students that leave to go to charter school go to PAT Charter. And so it's kind of a fun tool to play around with, and just enter different districts and you can see where students are coming in and leaving. And that last tab there, you can see district change over time. And we can leave the district that's there now, or we can, but so right now that's Wayzata. And so there's some nice tables there that compare resident students to students served over time. You can see the change in students that are entering and leaving, and then some tables that you can see the percent change by year or the change in enrollment by year. So again, it's a nice way to see what's going on over time or for a particular year. Tells you kind of a nice story that you can see over time. And then we can turn to questions. I don't know if any members have any questions about those last few slides or the ones that preceded.
Thank you very much, Ms. Pera. Members, any questions? Well, it looks like you folks did it again. Members, just to, since legislators tend to be a bit of a competitive bunch, the real competition is not the days that the staff presentations are so informative that we don't have questions. The competition is the days that we're able to ask questions that stump the staff. Those don't happen very often, but if you want to, you know, get your competitive juices going, you can anticipate that for future committee hearings. Ms. Pera, Ms. Adrians, Mr. Strom, thank you very much for your presentations today and this week. Members, we will be meeting every day next week, so please anticipate that and look for committee postings from Ms. Burt. With that, enjoy the weekend. We are adjourned.